Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here with Martin, Santa's little helper, Willis.
Yay! I feel like an elf.
Yeah. I could see you being, you're human sized, but if you were shrunk down smaller, you would make a great elf.
I know. I just have to grow my goatee out a little bit and wear a little, coveralls and all that.
I think I would, too, though. Don't you think?
I think you would. Yeah.
We're Santa helpers, elves kind of dudes. Be fun.
Yeah. Have one of those little caps with the snowball on the end of it.
Yeah. You know? Santa would just be like, enough with the UFOs. Every kid doesn't need, you know, three different types of UFO models. And
that's right. And Santa's been called a UFO plenty of times.
Yeah, right. He's mistaken often for a UFO. So my guest is Richard Thiem. So he's really interesting. He spoke at the MUFON Symposium, and I've heard of him, and I've followed him a bit. He's a lecturer. He lectures mostly on technology. He's well known in the hacker. He goes to speaks at the hacker conferences and stuff on like this about kind of the philosophy of the future, and technology. But what's interesting, you know, he's been looking into how, technology's been, integrated into our lives for decades, even before, the point we got to where we are now, where, you know, it used to be, we weren't so reliant where, you know, hacking was something that in the past was kind of a novel thing, not going to affect our lives. But now, you know, it affects all of our lives so greatly. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about UFOs because he's also got an interest in that, and he's got some very interesting perspectives on how the kind of culture looks at UFOs and things like this. So it was just a great conversation. He's done so much research in this field and thinking about it that we only really scratched the surface of the topics we could talk about. So I'm sure I'll have him back again. But, I'm really excited about this talk.
Yeah, sounds great. I am interested to hear that because I know how technology has affected, you know, UFO sightings alone and, you know, the future of that.
Right.
Is going to go both ways, really good in detection and really bad as far as CGI and all that, as far as people hoaxing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a double-edged sword. There's going to be some really good coming out of it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, cool stuff. So, but let's move on because I know just like all of Santa's little helpers, they're busy this time of year, and so are you. Let's move to UFO news. What do you got for me?
Well, this is an interesting case. It's a low-flying UFO described as fluid. Now, this happened in Clinton, Missouri. And it's funny. The guest I had last week on my show mentioned something about people are, you know, there's all kinds of speculation, of course, when it comes to UFOs, but one of the speculations out there, and I have heard this before, is that a biological entity can come down from the upper atmosphere. I mean, it sounds crazy, maybe it's possible. You have to, of course, have an open mind when you're looking at this topic in general. But this happened back in November 4th of this year. And here's a quote from one of the witnesses. There were two of them. It was dark outside, pitch black. The and there was not enough light from the building lights on the exterior to illuminate anything. Suddenly, we noticed something moving about 100 feet away, and this was up above them. It was a silvery silhouette of an object in the form of a checkmark. And it had a fluid movement and changed shape several times. You know, this sounds like it could be like a balloon, and it was also in separate. It looked like it could have been 3 or 4 up to 5 segments long. It was hard to say. And it was located in the east, and it moved in a straight path to the southeast. Now, I don't know what direction the wind was blowing at that time. This was investigated by a Missouri MUFON investigator. They did not think it was a flock of birds. It did look like multiple objects. There were no lights. But the amazing thing is, something you do hear a lot, is all of a sudden the coyotes stopped howling at the time, and it was very quiet. And as this thing moved away and went away, the coyotes started howling again. You do hear a lot of things about animals, mm-hmm. You know, it affecting animals. Anyway, I thought it was a pretty good case, and it was investigated by the Assistant State Director, Margie Kay, and mm-hmm. she closed it as an unknown.
Yeah. Have you interviewed her?
I have not.
I have. You ought to talk to her. She's very interesting. She's kind of the she's very active. I think I think you said that, the Assistant State Director there in Missouri, but very busy person. She's been in this for a long time, so maybe you ought to look into that.
Is she an elf too?
Not Santa's that I'm helper? Aware yeah. of, but oh. You never know. You know, yeah, they could be her. Walking among us, and you know, not to scare the audience, but your coworkers, if you're at work right now, any one of them could be a Christmas elf.
Sort of a hybrid.
A hybrid, because they've probably mingled. Elves are known for their fairness. So I'm sure there has been some interbreeding that's happened. So that could be, you know, why, yeah. So new theories. Do you think the elves are aliens?
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that, because when you go back, you know, over the centuries, there's always been something, hasn't there? You know, there's been the elves and leprechauns and you know, on and on and on, spirits, mm-hmm. angels. Yeah. So
wouldn't that be cool if that's how, and I'm sure we could just by, you know, just like the Ancient Alien show, speculating makes it real. But it could be there was just these really nice aliens that came down and they're like, we want to give presents to all the humans. They're just these cute little hairless monkeys. Let's give them some presents. And they went around the world giving presents, and then we killed them and ate them. And
here we are.
There's an ancient alien story for you. The ancient alien Christmas.
That's right. That's right.
There's another interesting story that Roger wrote about. Roger from MUFON. He writes these MUFON sightings. I thought, and just another triangular one. Of course, there's so many of these. I think many of them turn out to be airplanes, and quite frankly, I think a couple of the they haven't been investigated, so I'm sure the investigators will feel similarly. But there have been a couple UFO videos submitted, put up on the MUFON's YouTube site from witnesses that look like planes. They're not triangles. You know, they're planes. Planes can look like that at night. But this is an interesting one, because this guy, this was November 17th at 8:45 p.m. This person saw this very brightly lit craft in Connecticut, New Milford, Connecticut. It was silent. But what is interesting here is that he says it made a perfect 90-degree turn. And at that point, he said he could see the underbelly and see it was a perfect black triangle. And then he lost track of it because he just kept going home. But yeah, another triangle one. I mean, triangle sightings are just so interesting. And it's going to be exciting, because we're going to have like a panel on triangle sightings, especially not just the Phoenix Lights, but around triangles at the UFO Congress with some people like, you know, the guy who wrote the book on it, literally, David Marler, and of course, great. Richard Dolan, who's very well versed on that sort of on sightings going back for many, many years. So that's going to be fun. But another story.
You know, so many people. Oh, I'm sorry. So many people just think they're just you know, secret military craft. I don't know. I'm on the fence of the triangles because they, you know, the sightings going back so far that I don't think we ever had that technology. We wouldn't know about it by now and be used in wars or whatever.
Yeah. Well, David Marler's book makes a, I think, strong argument that that's not the case, not completely the case. Mm-hmm. So right. does the NIDS. Robert Bigelow's group, his their report on black triangles, I think they make some good arguments that they're not military. So, but then again, you know, I've heard from witnesses like the guy with the black triangle Facebook page who says he was right under one, and to him it was obvious human technology. So it could be both, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I think so, because if you think about it, you know, of course you know, you're talking earlier sightings that, that it's just plain impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, who knows? You know, could we have reverse engineered something we found and are testing it out? I don't know. That's just another another thought.
Yeah, who knows? One other story I wanted to speak to and kind of hear, you know, what you've heard and what you think is there's this guy, Steve Longero. So Philip Mantle did an interview with another witness at the Rendlesham Forest. Of course, this was some sightings in late 1980 that was at a couple of bases in the UK that were on lease to the Americans, to the US Air Force. Secretly, there were nuclear missiles being housed there, and at least Colonel Holt, the deputy base commander, had seen this object come and kind of beam that area and also beam a light at their feet. The most common sighting out there was this kind of eyeball or football shaped light. And that's what this Steve Longero guy says he saw. He says, you know, he was a security guy. He was out there that night. And he saw that eyeball shaped thing and it kind of freaked people out. And he says he remembers seeing Colonel Holt, a couple of the other, well-known witnesses, John Burroughs and James Peniston, and he also says he saw Larry Warren, who was out there, a more controversial witness to these events, or, you know, alleged witness. There's some argument on whether or not he's telling the truth. He was out there. The issue it's gotten a lot of news, but the issue that Holt have with it and some others is he's not very clear. He's like, I think I saw this. I think I might have seen that. And so it seems like he's got his facts a little mixed up. He talks about everything happening in one night. It actually, the sightings were over several nights, and not everybody saw every night. So, and it sounds like he just saw one night. So it seems like, and I don't think you can blame the guy. It's been years that his memory is a little jumbled, and he doesn't remember the details, but he does remember being out there.
Yeah, yeah, that is interesting. I mentioned to you before, I have Charles Holt on my show coming up on this Wednesday, and he doesn't really like when I bring up Larry Warren, but I still may bring this up during the show to see what he has to say about it.
Yeah.
Steve Longero's, you know, account of seeing him there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, John, and we have the full interview, so at least some of the tabloids and stuff like that have excerpts of the interview, but we do have the full interview from Philip on our website at openminds.tv, so people can read that. We also have an interview that Philip did with the guy who wrote Colonel Holt's new book with him. So he is a co-author of this new book by Colonel Holt. His name is John Hansen. And I had there was a lady who replied to this. She said, I was at Rendlesham. I remember Colonel Holt the next day. And John Hansen several times has pointed this out to me, that they have a lot of new witnesses that you haven't heard of in their book. So there's a lot of great witnesses in there, this new book that came out. But Holt said, I don't remember that lady. I wasn't in the hospital the next day. So again, this could be someone who was at Rendlesham. She remembered seeing Holt, you know, maybe one of those days around the time the event took place, maybe weeks or months later. But she just, you know, doesn't remember exactly when. But, yeah, so you could read that other interview as well with John Hansen about the Holt's book. So Rendlesham, this is like Roswell. It's a story that never goes away, but it's kind
That's
of
right. Coming up on the anniversary in a couple of days.
But like Roswell is so important here, you know, Rendlesham Forest incident is very important in the UK, and we do have Colonel Holt speaking at the UFO Congress about his new book and about the case also. So that ought to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, great. And this, you know, the Rendlesham Forest incident, you know, has this Department of Air Force document. I mean, this is one of the well-documented cases out there titled Unexplained Lights, and you have a PDF copy in the interview. It's really it gives me a chill every time I read that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's an official document explaining this object, this craft.
Yeah, I know. That's what – another thing that makes this so unique is that you have this official telling of the story. And what's interesting is the backstory too. You know, Colonel Holt, now he's more enthusiastic about speaking about the sighting. And, of course, he's written this book and everything. But he wasn't then. He was reticent to write that report. But he yes. did it, and he certainly did not want this news to get to the public, because it's embarrassing. You know, you're a colonel
right.
you're on a base. You don't want to be related to UFOs or even talk about them, because you just like anybody, you get teased and everything. And so he's kind of had to take this on begrudgingly, and some might argue a little grouchily. He's a colonel.
One of the questions I'm going to ask him is, if Larry Warren didn't spill the beans in the thing and nobody else did, would he have just kept quietly his entire life about the whole thing? Which I think it's probably going to be yes, he would, but I want to hear what he has to say about it.
Yeah, well, and you know, there were other leaks of information other than Larry. Larry was the first, so it probably would have got out there either way.
Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then again, I think that's why people argue maybe it was disinformation or Larry's memory was screwed with. He even had said maybe that's the case because his version is some of the aspects of what he remembers are much more wild and difficult to accept than the other witnesses. And his like, version getting out there first kind of tainted the whole thing, I think, and made it more skeptical, people more skeptical than perhaps they would have been if it would have been documents and things like that that would have come out first. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. Who knows? It's a mysterious world, the world of UFOs.
It certainly is.
Mm-hmm. Like I've said several times, it almost seems like it is enigmatic for enigmatic. Oh, I never get this right, too. Enigmaticity's. I don't know. It's weird. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, that's good enough.
All right. Anything else, my friend?
No, I am washed up here.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm sorry you're washed up, but we'll get you revived and back in it. I hope you have a good trip out there. And, again, thanks so much for joining us for the news again.
Very good. I'm really looking forward to hearing the show. And we'll talk to you next week.
All right, yeah. Let's go ahead and talk to Richard Thieme. I am very happy to welcome to the show Richard Thieme. Welcome.
Hi there. It's great to be with you, and I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Yeah, you know, I've actually been reading some of your work or looking at it for the last few years, and I've been intending to invite you to the show. In fact, I kind of had felt – I always get mixed up that we had talked at one point, but we hadn't. And then a friend of mine, Morgan – who Biao, yeah, who put on the MUFON conference, reminded me, and so we connected, which is great.
Terrific. It's good to do it at last.
Mm-hmm. So you've got an interesting background in technology. I know you lecture like at hacker conferences and things, correct?
I do. I call them, I speak there. Lecture sounds formal and academic, and they're usually not. I'm a professional speaker, and I have been for over 23 years, mm-hmm, as well as an author. And HackerCons opened up for me many, many years ago. This is 16, so it would have been 1996. There was an opportunity to do a keynote for a much smaller con called DEF CON. There were a total of 375 people in 96, and they needed a keynoter. And I had been writing and addressing technology as issues, and jumped at the chance. And Jeff Moss, who's known as Dark Tangent in the trade, gave me the opportunity. And this last summer, I spoke for the 21st straight year at DEF CON.
Wow.
This year there were 25,000 rather than 375. And that opened a lot of opportunities. There were people there, not only hackers, as people think of hackers, and you have to go back 20 years to say these were kids in the main working on creatively exploring the network, which was like a huge big toy that had been presented to them. It wasn't anything like the global system we have today, with all the many, many layers and good and bad places in the net. And yet, because they were sharp and because some far-seeing people knew what was up, there were people there from CIA and NSA and so on. And some of those people I became close to over the years, having, mm-hmm, formerly been a clergyman. We formed a bond on a basis of mutual trust. And so I have been independent for all this time. I don't belong to any organization, but I work for all of them across the board. So an awful lot of other hacker and security and intelligence conferences became opportunities for doing speeches to illuminate the impact of technology on a variety of areas, mm-hmm, as well.
So that being that's a huge one. Story. I mean, especially when you started doing this, we weren't as plugged in. But now, as we dived kind of headlong into this, almost maybe haphazardly, and we're all plugged in to a level where we're so vulnerable. We're extremely vulnerable at this point when it comes to the online world and hacking and everything. And it's kind of a scary place we find ourselves, it seems.
Well, it is. It's kind of like if you look at evolution, it's like assume we once had hard chitinous exoskeletons like beetles and shed them in order to have the soft, vulnerable flesh, mm-hmm, that we have now. And we did that because in our tribe of seven, we could always trust each other to have our backs and not to betray the tribe. And suddenly you have the several billion people on the planet, all flesh, and everybody suddenly has a gun or a spear or any weapon that penetrates flesh easily. Flesh is very, very easy to get through. That's kind of what we built with the Internet. It was built for trust originally out of a DARPA project with the military, corporations, and academia. They cooperated on creating openings, portals for each other to use, on the assumption that trust could be counted on. It was not envisioned, except perhaps by a few visionaries, as a global platform for every aspect of our lives, whether, mm-hmm, telecommunications or military or now the Internet of Things, which is terribly vulnerable to all sorts of hacks, cars, have been shown to be hackable, and it's a spy versus spy kind of game to try to stay ahead of the defenders, but the defenders always win. I wish the defenders always win. That was a Freudian slip. The attackers almost always win because they only have to get in once, whereas you have to defend against every possibility of getting in, and when you've got millions and millions of lines of code, There are exploits that are discovered, used, and sold that make the millions and millions of dollars of crime and larceny and theft available, as well as identity theft and locking down your computer for ransom and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we've created a monster. It could have been built for security. Security and convenience are always a trade-off. So if you want security, you have to accept inconvenience. And if you want convenience, you have to accept insecurity. You can't have both.
Mm-hmm.
And the decision long ago was to have convenience and ease of access and freedom of movement. And the network we inhabit today, to our peril, is the result.
Mm-hmm. So that is a world that, worldwide focus has come into all corporations and companies and government agencies. Anybody online has a great interest in it. And I'm sure there are lots of opportunities to go speak and to discuss that topic in the mainstream. So it's probably, got its own industry. However, when it comes to UFOs, it's kind of still a grassroots type of thing. There's really no industry, and even most lecturers volunteer their time. So what got you into the wanting to start doing talks on UFOs?
Finally wanting to tell the truth about something that over many years had become compelling. And the resistance on the part of those who might know more, that's all we can say, might know more, to allowing a free and full discussion of the facts and the data in the interest of a generalized population-wide exploration of what has been happening since, say, the 1940s, the modern era, as we call it. That reticence to allow that or enable it and the actual countermeasures to prevent it intensify your obsession with it. So I would say I share that obsession, although not to the degree of that some have, but it makes you want to know. Mm-hmm. I do a talk now, for example, on trauma in the intelligence and security worlds, what it does to people to do the work and keep secrets. And Robert Powell, who's the one of the head investigator for MUFON and co-author of our book, UFOs and Government, A Historical Inquiry, a brilliant guy, he suggested that the impact on UFO observers, you don't have to be an abductee or an experiencer, just someone who had an encounter with an otherworldly or radically different anomalous vehicle or event, has the same problem, because you want to talk about it and it's taboo. It's been made taboo by design and intention since the 50s, when policies began to evolve. And so the effect on you is to make you want to know even more, but you can't do it openly. So that's part of my motivation, but part is just somebody called me a need-to-know machine. I've wanted to know what's going on to the degree that I can. I have a brain that allows me to process certain kinds of information on behalf of insight and ultimate enlightenment in some domains. And when I was a kid, UFOs were a fashionable thing. I didn't know much about them growing up in the 50s. Other than what I read, there were flaps in the 60s, as you know, and in the 70s, thanks to Alan Hynek and others who had popularized the notion in a legitimate and respectable way, there was a widespread interest in UFOs. And in 1978, the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind was playing in the neighborhood theater. When I was in my first parish as an Episcopal clergyman in Clearfield, Utah, on the edge of Hill Air Force Base, and one of the members of the parish was a fighter pilot who had my absolute respect and still does. He was decorated for valor in Vietnam. He had the right stuff. He was that kind of guy. He retired from the Air Force as a bird colonel. And we were talking in the church basement one night alone when I said, "Bob, you know, all I know is I read about these things. And what I read is that you chase them in your fastest fighters and you can't catch them. What's the story?" And he said, "Well, that's correct." He said, "We chase the damn things in our fastest fighters and we can't catch them." And he related a story of a colleague who has a typical story, you know, flying, and anomalous vehicles zoomed out of nowhere, circled him, paced him, and then took off at a speed that he knew that we could not match with our technology. So that was a contextual shift for me in 1978. What's real about this? It had become real. It had become something part of the phenomenal domain as a result of that conversation, rather than a metaphor or story or tale or narrative, which I was familiar with as I used to teach English literature before going into the ministry at the University of Illinois. And suddenly it was real, and I wanted to know what I could. And that began an exploration, which is 78, what is it, almost 40 years ago. Finding out what I could. And in the same way that I did with technology, with my background, which is not a technical background, the way I have learned is by putting myself in a position to learn from people who know a great deal more than I do. In UFO domain, there are an awful lot of people who say anything or believe anything, and I try to avoid that. But there are other people, like I will say, the co-authors of the book, UFOs and Government, headed by Mike Swords, who is an absolutely brilliant, brilliant thinker. I escalated my game, put it that way. I got myself appointed as state director of MUFON so I could interview people. I used that opportunity to write a couple of pieces on it long ago, and used that opportunity to interview key people. I still have those interviews, a dozen or 15 of those, with key people, and interviewing is a good way to self-educate. So I chose the best people. And then I was very fortunate, talking to Jan Aldrich of Project 1947 some years ago, and he said, "Well, you know, we're meeting down in Dallas, some of us, to discuss writing white papers. Do you want to come down to that?" That was very fortuitous, because that allowed me to take place in a weekend conversation, the result of which was not white papers, but UFOs and Government. With Mike's lead, the decision was made to write a book. And Mike's research is unimaginably extensive, and is on top of Lauren Gross, who did these incredible monographs year by year monitoring UFOs. One of the things about people who are really bright and respectable is that they honor and learn from other people who are really bright and respectable. There's a lot of sharing of information. And when that book was chosen as the vehicle, Mike was you know, by far the lead writer. With the rest of us all contributed as we could. Robert Powell organized the project, which was not trivial. It took us 5 years, an incredible amount of work, just getting gent named Purcell, had to get permissions for all these photographs. That was not trivial. It was just not trivial. But we never met again in person until the book was done 5 years later. It was all passed back and forth over the internet, and now we're very, very proud of that book. But I knew Mike Swords because I had wanted to escalate my games. I had gotten to know Mark Rodiger at Kufos in Chicago and said I really wanted an opportunity to find out what the best people in the area, not always the ones you know about on the internet or making videos on YouTube, what they knew. And Mike came over from Kalamazoo and spent a weekend mentoring and tutoring me, along with a number of other people who were in that room at Kufos. They spent a weekend letting me ask every question I had. And it's kind of like hacking. You don't go online to a hacker forum and say, "I want to hack, tell me how." You do all the work you can to learn how to do it, and then you wait and ask your elders and seniors with respect and deference questions that show you've done all your homework. And it was those kinds of questions that I could ask that enabled me to, as I say, escalate my game and be part of the conversation with Barry Greenwood and Jan Aldrich and Purcell and Robert and Mike and others who participated in creating that book. And so now, you know, that book is a gold standard for historical research. The data in it is bulletproof. There are nearly 1,000 footnotes, and they all go to government documents that these guys have unearthed over 50 years or to other primary sources. And the book is currently in, I think, at least 65 university libraries and is recommended for inclusion in all university libraries because it's so solid. And so that's the story. I was going to say the short story, but it's not very short. how I moved from this is real to learning as much as I could, using all the various means, reading everything, exploring everything, interviewing people myself. As a clergyman, I had some adeptness in evaluating what I was hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And doing research. I used to teach a course at Illinois on how to do research. And that has stood me in good stead to find out information and communication with and conversations with selected people from the intelligence community has contributed to that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, UFOs and government, a historical inquiry, I would agree with you. I think it's one of the most important books, I think, in the field. I have been friends with Robert Powell for many years. He comes on the show quite a bit. And so I knew about the inception and the whole process. So I had been excited for 5 years for that thing to come out. So I was really happy when it did. And it did not disappoint. But you mentioned how it is difficult with all the information out there to find good information. What are some other sources you would recommend for people? Tough one.
It's a tough one because you start not with names of people, but you start with the data. Mm-hmm. One of the things Mike Swords has done, and others have done, who had voluminous amounts of research. See, the real problem was when we met Mike's basement in Kalamazoo, the walls were filled with file cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
His bookshelves looked like the stacks of a library. Most of those books, he's not going to, you know, contribute to somebody because most of them don't. This is important to know. I mean, I look at all the UFO books on my shelf. Which ones do I go back to? Virtually none. You know, we go back to Alan Hynek and the first scientific exploration. I enjoy reading Jacques Vallée and talking to Jacques about what's going on. There are other books that have plenty of cases, but what's online now? Lauren Gross's files are all online. Mike's files are online. Isaac Coy's files are online. Barry is loading files. Project 1947, under the stewardship of Jan Aldrich, is full of good files. You go online and start moving through these files. Well, this is where research begins. The daunting aspect is that there are thousands of them, and you have to have filters. excuse me. We don't look at simple lights in the sky or single witness cases. You try to escalate to the best data and the best evidence, and then you look at those, and you use the best people who can do an analysis, who really can help you sort out what's weather phenomena, or what is likely to have been a cover story for a test of our own advanced technologies. When you get UFO reports, you know, 4 miles from Edwards Air Force Base, you want to look at that kind of carefully. I do know that from inside the intelligence community, people have been very clear that anything I'm likely to learn about out here and anybody else's has been known or explored 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't become known for a long, long time. You can look at the U-2. You can look at stealth technology. These things were developed and visible and misunderstood before we had names for them. And that's especially true now. Some of the things we are doing with technology is astonishing. But you have to really know what you're doing. You can't just go on the narratives. The internet, like you say, is full of, well, now we've got a lot of emphasis on fictional stories that half the country believes.
If not more.
The same is true with UFO stories.
Right.
I've walked into conferences where people are talking about, it sounds like Dungeons and Dragons to me, where they've identified a whole variety of alien invaders by type, by visuals, and by intention. They know about this cosmic warfare going on. You know, the truth is that's just all nonsense. So you really have to have a nonsense filter to say, what is the data that supports that? Just as you do with Comet Pizza in the news today, what is the data that suggests that all the people in the government are engaging in pedophile parties and satanic ritual? Well, actually, none. And it's the same with these arcane narratives that people want to believe because they're exciting, and they give you the illusion that you know, and that calms your cognitive dissonance, that quiets your anxiety. And people project way prematurely onto a few stars in the sky. Oh, that's a bear. Well, it could be a pig. You just don't have enough data to connect the dots yet. So you start with the data, and you start with learning methodologies that enable you to research the data appropriately and leave yourself a pile of gold, and not fool's gold, and not dross, but good data, from which you can then infer a wide variety of things. We refer to the book UFOs and Government. One of the things that's very clear from that book is that UFOs are real. It's clear, even if you never saw a UFO, from the response of the government for half a century or more to the phenomena in light of national security concerns, which were legitimate and very urgent in the 50s, when the Cold War with the Soviets was really cranking up. So you can infer from the way people managed the phenomena as a narrative in the mind of society that they were doing something serious, something real, something that took some resources, and something that had been decided. Mm-hmm. You know, Prime Minister of England once said, you know, things don't just happen to happen. You don't have to make it a conspiracy. People meet in rooms, make decisions, and then formulate plans and execute them. That's mm-hmm. the human project. And they did make a variety of people made a concerted effort to cover up the story. Well, then that means you have to have a real understanding of cover stories and how they work, how illusions and misdirection and ultimately ridicule of credible people are the primary weapons in that arsenal. To make it taboo, as I said, to make it likely that people will not discuss openly something that is hiding now in plain sight, because they couldn't control the phenomena. Mm-hmm. They couldn't make it stop showing up. They couldn't make encounters not happen. What they could do is ridicule and debunk and explain away and make it impossible for people to feel good about going public with credible stories, as well as risking their careers. Now, a lot of the stories, you know, came from airline pilots or the like. And once you've been told that you must have been drinking by a superior, the word got around pretty quickly. You don't talk about these things in public. So there develops what I call a black market in truth. It's no different than having contraband available, but you have to know where to go to get it. Mm-hmm. And then you have to be very careful about not believing agents of disinformation, whether they are sponsored agents of disinformation for the purpose of debunking, or what the communists called useful idiots, people who are naive and promulgate stories because they don't know any better. Mm-hmm. And that's as powerful a kind of disinformation as an organized plan.
Right.
So it's not easy. To look at alloys, you know, you hear metal being analyzed. I have plenty of stories, but they're stories. I can't verify them. But we have plenty of stories that we've accumulated over alloys being developed in response to the alloys that are likely to be found on craft that we can't, couldn't in the old days, emulate before nanotechnology. The behavior of light in fibers before we had fiber optics. There are a number of technologies that you can make a case for saying at least the idea, the theoretical physics behind the exploration of and development of these technologies may very well have come from at least reverse engineering the concepts. But in order to explore whether that's true, you really have to know material science. You have to know nanotechnology. You can't just take somebody's simplistic story. So, like anything worthy of exploration, you have to do an awful lot of homework first. And that's very, very careful.
And that seems to be the difficulty, especially when a lot of the more prominent voices, or at least that have the attention of larger groups of people, and partially from the television shows out there, they espouse a lot of information and data, but unfortunately, and it's something I found by following trying to source the data, it's unsubstantiated often, and it's not strong data. And
that's right.
So a lot of people are speculating and making a lot of assumptions that then become truths for others, and people assume, oh, well, if they're saying that, then it must be what's going on, and not realizing that they should have probably prefaced it with, I'm speculating that this is the case,
right?
Which nobody does, unfortunately, or very rarely do people do that. And so there's a lot of, for lack of a better term, useful idiots out there, and so it does become, I think, difficult for people.
Right. Absolutely it does. Plus, it changes you to have an encounter. Mm-hmm. My background was religious experience in the ministry, and sometimes it's hard to distinguish between what's outside and what's inside. And people claim religious experience originated outside, prompted by narratives of religious traditions which predispose you to have what I call a hierarchical restructuring of your psyche, which each religion provides the means to have, but they have different narratives. Christians call it being born again. Buddhists call it a nightmare in daylight, enlightenment, and so on. Everybody provides the narrative that will encourage you to have the experience, but they explain it in different ways. Well, that religious experience is hardwired. That's why humans have them all over the world when they're prompted by their cultures to experience it. UFO experience often seems to me to be somewhat similar. Mm-hmm. People are encountering something that's anomalous, that's outside the ordinary, certainly outside their everyday experience, and which, in terms of the belief systems or structures of understanding they've developed, is fundamentally challenging. It's a brick through the window. Because if this is true, then a lot of the things I have believed are not true, or some others may be true, and I don't know. And I don't know what I know, and I don't know what this is. And at the same time, there are reports of the impact on consciousness itself and on memory of the encounter. Now, some of that may be because we can't allow ourselves to know and remember what we experience when it challenges us so deeply in our fundamental beliefs. But it also may be encouraged from the outside. And again, I know from the exploration of intelligence methodologies, playing with memory, playing with consciousness is very, very much a part of the game. And it's done in all sorts of subtle ways. And that goes off on a whole other track, people who tell me that their electronic mind control experiments are being done on them. And you ask for the evidence, and of course it's worse than UFOs, because UFOs are real. That is phenomenal, and can be repeatedly observed, although not in a predictable way. And so this adds another wrinkle. It's really interesting. So many people who have an experience of a UFO encounter report what you would call paranormal experience. They report telepathic experience. I interviewed a woman not that long ago who was under a hovering UFO, she and her mother. Her mother was terrified, and then the fear went away. And when the fear went away, she said she got two very clear messages. And I said, is it possible you just thought them? And she said, no, it wasn't like that. I heard a voice in my head. Well, you know that we've heard those stories before. And what was the voice saying? I asked. And she said, we wanted you to see us, and we're not going to hurt you. Don't be afraid. Now, I asked if it was possible to just infer that they wanted her to see him, because here's a anomalous UFO hovering above her garage mm-hmm. in a suburb of Milwaukee. And she said, no, it wasn't an inference that I formed on the basis of thinking that. It was a voice telling me we wanted you to see us. Now, when you go back to explore the hard data, Mike Swords has written a beautiful piece on how much some events only make sense if they were intended to be displays, sometimes seen at a great distance from someone, like a circumscription of the moon in a particular geometric pattern that required a particular angle of vision that someone had to know was possible for a person on Earth at a particular time and place. But an awful lot of the patterns seem to suggest intentional display over a long period of time, intermittently to reinforce the reality, but to do it in a way that it becomes a part of the narrative of the mind of society, and a way which allows the authoritative voice to remain silent. Now, what do I mean by that? It's a critical piece. People say, why don't they land on the White House lawn? Well, for one thing, especially today, would you land on the White House lawn, Trump's White House? You might, just to create a reality show, but you'd land on the White House lawn if you, A, acknowledged our layers of governmental oversight and wanted to talk to a president. They don't, and you can talk to a president without landing on the White House lawn. No, so many of the sightings you know are in obscure areas or at night, far away, or only to a few people. Mm-hmm. And so many of them have happened that way.
What's that?
Mm-hmm. Well, just that it suggests that if there's an intention behind it that we can infer on the basis of how we think and how we do things, then the intention that's suggested is intermittent reinforcement over time to change the belief system of a society, to include the reality of the phenomena, and ultimately to include either other dimensional or other terrestrial, extraterrestrial beings. It includes mm-hmm. intelligence that's not ours and not from here. Wherever or from whatever time, from whatever place it's from, we don't know how to understand that easily. But it would suggest that the progressive reinforcement all over the world in the pattern I described might be to the end of having us exactly where we are now, which is talking about this all over the place. Everybody knows what UFOs are. But it prevents the authoritative voice from saying, yes, it's true. And that's what the debunking has been so successfully enabled by. People ask me how our book, UFOs and Government, was received. It's not ridiculed. They can't ridicule it. The data is bulletproof. It's received with silence. The authoritative
right.
voice doesn't speak.
But even
says,
in
a, yes.
Uh-huh. Even without debunking, in an environment where the authoritative voice might be more accepting, an example being, let's say, Chile. The Chilean government is very open and transparent about UFOs, and they've even had official, you know, meetings to discuss motives and things like this. But it doesn't disturb this overall kind of model what you're talking about, but it doesn't really add to it. It just their voice is similar to any other person's voice almost, in that it's very much like what you had mentioned before. They're finding the same thing. They're coming around. They're showing themselves. We chase them once in a while, but we can't catch them. However, it doesn't seem to be there doesn't seem to be any malintent or posing any sort of threat. So even in the instance of a government going that far, it doesn't change things much, actually. It doesn't change that what you talked about maybe happening, this exposure that adjusts belief systems, it would still operate. The same way, with or without.
And we're also plagued here in this country, as you know, by the not invented here syndrome. I've lived in other countries, and healthcare, for example, tests, studies that reveal the efficacy of drugs and so on, they're generally not received from other countries. They have to be duplicated here, as if we cannot trust their methodology. You have not only Chile or Brazil, but the French, who have reinstated their official program on UFOs. And you have a statement from the equivalent of the head of NASA saying, we don't understand why the United States is doing this. We can only speculate, too. But they're putting out all kinds of disinformation that prevents us from evaluating the phenomena on a global basis, cooperatively. The Italians have done some great work. But it's as if, oh, France, oh, the Italians, oh, Chile, oh, Brazil. Even Western Europe, which ought to be on our radar as a source of respectability, it's as if it doesn't exist. You've got the head of the equivalent of NASA in a modern, progressive European country saying, no, this is real, and why do they keep debunking it? And he gets the same silence that the rest of us get. Mm-hmm. And so he can only speculate, he says, that this is done to... because there are alien technologies that we want to develop and we don't want anyone else to get, or because there's some other clandestine reason. And you know, one of the alarming ones, there are all sorts of alarming scenarios of experimentation and cooperation between the military and the government and the aliens and so on. We don't know what's real about that. But we do know that if the reports from Brazil early on were accurate, there have been casualties during encounters, whether intentional or not. People have been injured. People have died. I interviewed people here in Wisconsin in relationship to a case up in, I'm forgetting the name of the town, the northwest part of the state. It's a well-known case because the police officer had gone across town in pursuit of a UFO, and they lost track of him. They lost signal. And when another police officer went and found him, he was lying, coming to consciousness again. He said, the damn thing zapped me. And he subsequently had illness and subsequently died months later. But they could never identify what the source of his physical malaise was. And I spoke to the officer who found him just to verify that was legitimate. And he said, that's exactly what happened. Well, I can't get beyond that. See, I can't do the autopsy. I can't get beyond that officer with the proper affect, appropriate to what he was telling me, verifying that happened. So there's that alarming possibility, too. And you probably know about the 1970s textbook that the U.S. Air Force Academy put out, where there was a chapter about anomalous phenomena. Half the chapter was pretty good cases. And it made the statement that the uncorrelated data suggests 3 to 4 different civilizations visiting the Earth. Well, that story was finally outed by the Inquirer, which is also an interesting path to go down, where the Inquirer came from and how those periodicals operate on behalf of debunking stories. And the Inquirer covered it. That meant nobody legitimately was ever going to cover it. And meanwhile, the book was retracted, pulped, all copies destroyed. And a new copy issued, new edition, that had that chapter changed completely and all the cases removed, no statements removed as well. But you have that statement in an Air Force textbook, 3 to 4 different civilizations. What do you do with that? We have that chapter now. You can get it on the Internet. Mm-hmm. And what you can do with it is so much of what you can do, so like what you can do with this stuff. As you know, you can talk about it the way we are, and you say, huh, how about that? You can spin off these elaborate space opera scenarios as if you know who these civilizations are and their intentions. You can infer, as Mike Swords has done, these are the likely advanced civilizations in the galaxies and how they would likely develop and what they might be interested in. He's got 3 possible scenarios. Or you can just say, isn't that interesting? because it doesn't correlate. It doesn't connect to anything else. It doesn't give us more data to which to connect it to say, yes, there's the reptilians and there's the Nordics and there's the tall whites and there's the small grays and there's on and on. We don't know what it means, but they were obviously going on the reports of different kinds of humanoid entities seen near craft before craft departed. So unless there's more disclosure of facts and data.
Assuming there's facts and data to be disclosed or
well, that's right. That's right. Hal Putoff, who's explored this stuff a lot, he's an NSA guy, works with remote viewing. He says disclosure is not the right word. He says you want confirmation because, as Mike Sword says, we've got so much data out here, as you know, too. I mean, the data repositories that I mentioned, we have an awful lot of data. We can't answer all the questions or go down all the roads to explore all the questions we have, but we have a lot of the same data.
Mm-hmm.
And to the degree that the phenomena keeps itself hidden in terms of its intentions and sources, ultimate destinations, ultimate goals, and where it comes from.
You know,
go ahead.
You discussed earlier about, you know, the results, what may be the intention, but is certainly the results of the phenomena, is that people are witnessing these things and, like you said, kind of having a religious experience. That's actually what my talk is going to be at the UFO Congress, is about religion and UFOs. And that's essentially the gist, is that although it's kind of a subtext of my talk, is that it does, you know, this is what's happening. People are witnessing something. They're having this religious experience. It's something they believe to be a UFO, and maybe it is. In some cases it's not, but it still has the same effect just because we have this idea of UFOs.
That's right.
In the culture. And then they look to they strive. It's like they have a hunger to then find a belief system that either supplements their religion or in some cases replaces it, but incorporates this idea of UFOs and extraterrestrials. And often they find most people aren't comfortable. I think a lot of people, probably yourself, myself, I think Robert's the same, we're comfortable with not knowing and continuing to look till we find something. A lot of people aren't, so then they attach themselves to these belief systems that others are involved with, which are no better, in some cases a little worse if you take in to think of like what the Stargate, the people who committed suicide. So they're finding these belief systems that incorporate the idea but are still just kind of as out there or, you know, wild as some of the things you had mentioned
earlier. Well, that's absolutely right. And you may recall, I quoted Nietzsche when I did my talk at the MUFON Symposium last time, who said, in the face of cognitive dissonance, in the face of fear, in face of the unknown above all, what people do is search for the first explanation that comforts them, that alleviates their anxiety and fear. And people can only tolerate so much ambiguity and complexity. We see that across the board with all the simplistic discussions taking place and reaching more people than we wish they would. And so people develop these scenarios that are always explanations in terms of the known or possible that comfort them, and they call that truth. And then when enough people exchange those truths, we have dogma and we have movements. And unfortunately, the Internet has facilitated the easy coalescence into insane movements of exactly the kinds of things you're talking about. But it would also include religions as well. I was in the clergy, Episcopal ministry. How many denominations or religions subsets are there of one kind or another in Christianity itself? A couple hundred? Each one proclaims the whole truth, nothing but the truth. So help us God. But each one can't be right. If any one is right in saying the way we interpret the narrative in this literal way or this interpretive way, then we're right and everybody else is wrong. If that's true, then you see what you just described applies to ufology, applies to religion.
Right.
It's the human dilemma of the ease with which the ignorant assimilate and then attach to with inordinate passion the truths that enslave them rather than set them free.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to get, because I know we're a little short on time, and so I want to get to the next section I would like to talk about, in that we've been talking about a lot about data and the importance of the data, especially the good data, which is such a small amount of the data that is out there, it seems. But there are people who are, you know, putting out the bad data. One of those, probably the largest group, being the useful idiots with their assumptions and unsubstantiated claims. But the other part that you talked about was the disinformation. How abundant and how hard do you think the government has worked on spreading disinformation?
Well, I can't quantify it. You uh-huh. ask a quantifiable question, and I know I don't have anywhere near the access I would have to things I can never access mm-hmm. to understand who said to who, do this. I do know that the resources are significant. A friend of mine told me he was talking to somebody in the U.S. Army about how could they do that? How could they undertake kind of plans you're talking about? And he said, I'll never forget the laugh. He says, you have no idea what we can do with resources. Now, my other explanations have included the use of the media and the media itself as agencies that spin these webs of narrative through the mind of societies, often for good, with good journalism, and often for bad. You can't tell without some third point and what some third point of reference that enables you to evaluate conflicting assertions. Somebody can say anything and then dare you to disprove it, like the idiots you're doing with the Comet pizza thing. They say here, well, you have to, the burden of disproof of a non-existent event is on you. Well, at that point your mind just gets tangled knots and mm-hmm. You can't believe what you're hearing. You don't know. Sometimes disinformation, like the whole Doty affair, the aviary, that sort of thing, becomes seemingly clear. We do know also that UFO stories have been used to cover up advanced technologies, happily so. Sources, good sources in the Air Force have said we've done it for years and it works really well. Gulf Breeze is a good example. A friend down there at Eglin Air Force Base who said they think what they're seeing are UFOs. They were testing drones long before drones were known about as drones, with a name that gave them a handle we could hold.
And in those instances, the disinformationists may not even be concerned about muddying the waters around the UFO topic.
That's right.
Because they may know nothing or not really have any concern about that topic.
No, the context has been created where someone could say, they want to see UFOs? As my friend said, let's show them some UFOs.
Right.
Because the context existed on the basis of other debunking. Using the media, going back to the 50s when this was decided. So let's use Arthur Godfrey. There's a famous one-hour documentary from Walter Cronkite, or news program. And Uncle Walter, everybody trusted, absolutely. You know, at a time when CBS had a signed contract with the CIA. As did Time Life, as did the New York Times, as did the Washington Post, as did the Louisville Courier, as did 200 to 300 journalists, including the best. And it was as recent as 1996 that public affairs guy at CIA said, one good journalist is worth 10 agents on the ground. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, they're going to do whatever they can. And it doesn't take much. These days, the problem is there's this pushback from these independent news sites like Breitbart or InfoWarCon and so on, to which people go instead of ever reading mainstream media. So they don't have an alternative narrative. Given that, it doesn't take much. I used to say of ufology, it was easy to, as long as you have an opposition. People say there's a Holocaust. It's existed without controversy for decades, the fact of it, and all of a sudden somebody says there's no Holocaust, and you get pushback, and a group and people form and become the anti-Holocaust group, and now you can't talk about the Holocaust without including, and I blame the media for this, there has to be a pro and an anti on every talk show. So if you have an idiot from the left, you have to have an idiot from the right. and given that dynamic, often it validates the credibility as a spokesperson of both people in the process of creating the dialogue. And you go to some UFO conventions and you see on panels precisely those people who have become known for being known. Like celebrities. A celebrity is someone who's known for their well-knownness. they've become known by debating one another and given credibility to one another. A lot of the Roswell debates are about that. Given that fact, you've got a cottage industry where people derive either psychological gain or financial gain or hidden ulterior motive gain from participating in those kinds of scenarios. Makes it very, very, very difficult, unless you get your hands on the absolute documents that substantiate something. And that's why, again, going back to that book, there's nothing in there that isn't documented, and we avoid all speculation. But that also narrows the conversation to what is historically verifiable, and that's why it's about the government and its behaviors, because we can document that. The aliens, to my knowledge, or whatever they are, do not leave secret books lying around, you know, testimony to the contrary. And if they did, there's a wonderful story about a scholar who, middle-aged scholar of English literature, and he found a diary in an English bookstore, and it was written in code, and he just thought, what a treasure, and he took it home, and he worked and worked to decode the narrative, and he finally figured out how to crack the code, and he began translating the hundreds of pages of the diary. And it was just a fabulous book of life in, I think, 18th century England, full of richness and detail and intrigue at the palace and so on. Well, when he published his results, his colleagues insisted on seeing the original. What they discovered was here was a diary that had been written in English, but over the years, the ink had dried and cracked on the page into all these meaningless squiggles, and he had imposed his narrative on those squiggles.
Oh,
his
wow.
Extraordinarily creative unconscious, all unknown by him, had spun this wonderful narrative that he thought was translating, that in fact was self-created. And so I've never forgotten that.
That's really interesting, especially with this field, because a lot of people attribute these ideas and thoughts to these third parties entering their minds that they assume are extraterrestrial. But I've done hypnotherapy. I've got a certificate and everything.
Yeah. And yeah, tell me what you conclude about that, please.
Which is that, you know, in the therapy part, you use the mind's ability to do just what this gentleman did in order to help people help themselves. So, for instance, one of the most popular ways you help someone is tell them, you know, you bring them through some imagery and you get them to a comfortable, relaxed place, and you have them imagine a door that they're going to walk through, and on the other side of that door is going to be the person who's going to be able to help you with this issue. Or another way to do it is you're going to have a conversation with your higher self, your all-knowing self.
Well, I've done those with, I call them guided meditations.
Exactly. They essentially, that's what they are, a guided meditation, although with a therapist, you know, it's customized for you in particular with feedback. And sure enough, people come up with these elaborate ideas. Often the person on the other side of the door is no one they would have imagined would have been that person. And that person imparts whatever information they need to help themselves. But it's coming from inside. It's coming from their own
mind. I've written a novel called Foam, which came out just last year, and it's about an alien downsized into Earth form so he could do improv, in effect. with earthlings. And one of the groups he goes to is led by a New Age guru who does just those kind of meditations.
Mm.
And he goes into a cave and finds this little loincloth guru waiting who says, "God, you are so full of..." And he just lets into him. It's a comic riff on what we find there. But as you know, you find wisdom there. It's self to self.
Right.
It's yourself talking to yourself. But you just have to be careful because your other self, you call it your higher self, but your higher self may not be too many notches ahead of you.
Right, right. But
right, but itself, it's consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Consciousness embodied in imagery. And it is helpful, and it is therapeutic.
Right.
And it's empowering. I used mm-hmm. to do those in the ministry. We could go on. I see we're practically out of time. We could obviously go on for another hour.
Right. So we'll have
here.
To do this again because I feel, you know, we had to skirt along and we could have talked on any of those issues longer. But thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been so incredibly interesting, and I know that the listeners are going to really enjoy it as well.
Well, real pleasure talking to you. Really, mm-hmm. really good. I really appreciate it. It's great.
Is there a place, a website they can go to see some of your work?
Yeah. Yeah, themeworks.com. themeworks.com. www.themeworks.com. Or you can Google my name, and you'll find a lot of videos from my speeches on YouTube and elsewhere, but mostly YouTube. Good videos of recent talks. Yeah. Thanks.
All
thanks
right.
for mentioning.
Great. Okay. Yeah, definitely. We'll stay in touch, and we'll have you on again sometime.
Great. Talk to you later.
Talk to you later. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much to Richard Thiem for being on the show. I had a ton of fun with that conversation. Obviously, you know, Richard has put a lot of thought to this whole thing, and I find him fascinating. We'll definitely have to have Richard on again to talk more about many of the other subjects that we touched upon that. I'm sure both of us, I certainly would love to talk to him a lot more about some of those things. So really great to have him on the show. I apologize. I was not able to get a show together the last week or so. Of course, there was vacations and holidays and this and that. And guess what's coming up? More vacations and holidays and this and that. So I'm going to do my very best to have another show ready for Monday. I think I should be able to pull that off. However, Christmas is coming up, so the week after that, probably not. We've got this conference going off in the UFO Congress. And, of course, that's taking up a lot of time because we're getting really close now. We only have a couple weeks away. And, hey, you know what? I can give you guys some inside information like I usually do. And that is that James Fox is going to be speaking at the conference. And one of the things James is helping me with is he is gathering together. Some of you may remember or may not know who he is, but James Fox is a producer. And he's put together what I and I think many others would argue are the best documentaries on UFOs. Out of the Blue and I Know What I Saw. And each of those documentaries covered the Phoenix Lights, which of course is a very important case. And the year 2017 will be the 20th anniversary of that sighting. So we're doing some a lot of stuff to focus on that at our conference. And James is helping us get together some witnesses that you know, are great witnesses that had some incredible experiences those nights to demonstrate that, you know, the flares that the military had dropped south of here was not necessarily everything that happened and not the most exciting stuff. So that's going to be a lot of fun that we'll be able to hear firsthand from these witnesses. So that'll be great. So it's going to be a lot of fun at the Congress. We have at least one other surprise in store that we're working on that I think I'll be able to announce soon. But I can't say anything yet. So get your tickets if you haven't yet. They are going quickly, especially this time of year. Some of you may have gotten your mailer. We put together a mailer to kind of highlight what's going on at the conference, and we mailed those out this week. They're beautiful. Our buddy Eric McFarlane, who is our graphic designer, who is amazing, put those together. He's put together some other amazing art for this conference, including some cool t-shirts. And he may even have a table at the conference, which I think would be really cool because people can meet him. And I'm a huge fan. I mean, I think this guy is an amazing artist. And I don't think anybody would disagree that the art that we have at Open Minds, the creative, the graphics are just so professional and so cool. And this is all the work of Eric. So I think it'd be really fun and great for people to be able to meet him. Anyway, that's some of what's going on with the conference. Otherwise, check out our YouTube. We have a few more free videos out there. I think I mentioned this last time, but we have a video. Our last UFO reports went over the UFO WikiLeaks, so we have I think a great piece on that. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback, you know, overviewing what are the important emails that were part of these WikiLeaks that had to do with UFOs. Surprisingly, there were quite a few and some big stories, at least for our field. We also have another sighting up there from our archive, some photographs from Mexico that are really mysterious that you could take a look at. And yeah, so cool stuff up there, and it's all for free. Some videos that aren't free but are well worth the look is at our video portal. So the Open Minds UFO video portal, you can find that at openminds.tv. You will find lectures from previous conferences. So we have all of the 2016 UFO Congress lectures up there and many of the others, and we're adding more monthly. We've got dozens and dozens and dozens of videos from the top lecturers. You know, Jacques Vallée, we have Lee Spiegel, we have previous David Marler, we have, previous Richard Dolan, and we also have people like Bob Lazar up there. Who's got Bob Lazar? George Knapp. So a lot of stuff you're not going to see anywhere else. We do have a couple videos too. Witnesses of the Travis Walton case you will see nowhere else on our video portal. So it's well worth it. Couple bucks a month or a couple bucks to rent each of the videos. Anyway, that is it for today. Visit openminds.tv for more information on all of this, or the UFOCongress.com for information about the Congress. Also, I want to thank Caleb Hanks for the opening and close music. That is so cool. And Martin Willis for joining us for the UFO news at the top of the show. And of course, as always, I want to thank you, the listener, because Open Minds UFO radio listeners are just very, very cool people. Some of the coolest people. And I think we could prove that. But luckily, in this field, you don't have to prove a lot of stuff. You can just, like we talked about with Yelves, you can just kind of say it and just say it authoritatively. And that makes it real for many. So I'm saying it right here. Open Mind UFO radio listeners are the coolest, the smartest, the best looking, the most awesomest people, listeners out there. So that's pretty cool. And I look forward to talking to you again next week. Until then, adios muchachos.